Welcome back to Witch Hunt, where we delve into the darker corners of history and shine a light on the mystifying witch hunts of the past and present. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Josh. Today we have a truly fascinating episode. We're joined by Alice Markham Canner, a writer, fact checker, and descendant of one of the most well-known figures from the Salem Witch Trials, Martha Carrier.
That's right, Josh. Alice isn't just a descendant. She's also an author who has spent years researching not only the trials themselves, but how these types of persecutions continue to affect people across the globe today. Her new book, The Once and Future Witch Hunt, A Descendant's Reckoning from Salem to the Present, explores this historical and ongoing phenomenon.
It's incredible, Sarah, how Alice uses her unique lineage to dive deep into these issues, bringing them into a modern context. Today, she'll share how she discovered her connection to Martha, what that discovery led to, and how it transformed her understanding of witch hunts, both historical and contemporary.
Plus, Alice will talk about the broader implications of her research, including how today's witch hunts in various parts of the world are surprisingly similar to what happened in Salem centuries ago. It's going to be an eye-opening discussion about how the past is never really past.
We also discussed the upcoming documentary film, A Witch Story, which Alice made with Yolanda Pividal and Sylvia Federici. So stay tuned as we explore the echoes of Salem and the lessons they hold for our world today with Alice Markham Canner. Let's get started.
Welcome to Witch Hunt, Alice Markham Canner. Welcome to Witch Hunt. Can you introduce yourself and tell us about your background and professional work?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. I'm Alice Markham Canner. I am a writer from Brooklyn, New York, and I work as a fact checker. I worked in fact checking in magazines for the last 4.5 years. I have a degree in anthropology and sort of a background in interest in politics. And so the reason that I'm here today is that I am also the 9 times great-granddaughter of Martha Carrier, who was hanged in the Salem Witch Trials and wrote the book on her.
Yeah, and Martha Carrier is my first cousin, however many times removed.
Incredible. So, hello, cousin.
Hello, cousin. I descend from Frances Dane and from the Ingalls line. So, yeah, that's where I intercept her. So to speak.
Incredible. I know doing this really has made cousins come out of the woodwork. I thought I had a lot of cousins already, but now it's more.
Right. She's one of the ancestors we see with the most descendants just on social media. There's a lot of interest in Martha Carrier.
Yeah, that checks out.
Yeah.
Sort of she's a big personality. I think that there's so it draws people in, definitely.
She is. She gave back what the judges were given to her.
For sure. Right. She's sort of just speaking out about it pretty clearly.
Yeah. So how did you first learn that she was in your family?
Yeah. So I did not grow up knowing about this. It was like not a part of my family history. At some point, it gets lost in my family history. And I would be really interested to know, you know, when and like at what point do generations stop knowing about her? Like, is this sort of soon after Salem? Does it take a little while? No way of finding that out. But like my grandfather never knew, my mom never knew. And then when I was 13, my uncle was doing some genealogy research, as uncles do. He found her and sent us all this very casual email that was basically just like, oh, you know, we're descended from this woman who was killed in Salem. And we all sort of were like, no one really reacted. I remember that my grandfather's main reaction was to be like, oh, well, I hope she didn't hurt anyone. And my mom was like, Dad, what are you talking about? That's not what's going on here. But it was sort of like a non-issue. And then when I really got into this was the following year. I was visiting my brother at college and in his like college library and sort of wandering around, just looking around. And I saw a book a shelf. And I really could not tell you why I went over to this book, what book it was. I don't remember what the title was. I don't remember an author. But I went over to this book and I pulled it off the shelf and opened it. And it was about Salem. And her name was on a page. And I was like, oh, I know that name. That's familiar. And somehow that hooked me back in. And so then I was sort of, you know, lightly obsessed in the way that that teenagers can be. And then began to really deep dive while I was in my undergraduate years. And I ended up writing my thesis on Salem and sort of letting that be that was the intro into the research period, which then continued out after college. I was like, why stop? You know, once you're in, you're in.
And how did this research turn into a film and a book simultaneously?
Yeah, it was sort of a parallel. So while I was researching, I was starting to write the book. So I actually haven't really spoken about the book, so I'll do that really quickly, which is that the research has now become a book about Martha and about me. So it's a dual narrative that one of the narratives is written almost as historical fiction, although it is as true as I can make it based on the historical record we have access to. But it follows Martha's life and what happened in Salem as a way of exploring that. And then the other narrative is from my point of view, as I was sort of tracing that first year of research, as I was trying to understand what had happened and then started getting into researching witch hunts happening around the world today, which I'm sure we'll talk more about later, since that's also how I met you guys. So in the process of doing the beginning to write the book, I got in touch with Sylvia Federici, who wrote Caliban and the Witch, and has done a lot of work on the mother of the economic analysis of the Great Witch Hunts of Europe. I then ended up, she looped me into a conference that was happening in Spain in 2019. In Pamplona, that there's a campaign in Spain called the Campaña por la Memoria de las Brujas, the campaign for the memory of the witches, that is trying to dredge up, reclaim, actually learn about the witch hunts of Spain in the 15, 16, 1700s, because they had quite a few, and a lot of women, it's sort of like, we didn't actually learn about this. Like, this was sort of not taught to us in school as a part of our history. Let's dig into this. Where did this happen? Oh my God, this happened in my town square where I have been walking every day for my entire life and like never knew. So there's been a whole project to unearth this and sort of put it in its like political and religious context, analyze the history. And they're super cool. Highly recommend checking out the campaign's work. And they were hosting a conference in Pamplona that I ended up going to with Sylvia. And there, and I spoke there about Martha and about Salem. And there I met the woman who directed the film, who would go on to direct the film. So that's how that connection happened. So it's like, as I'm writing the book, also go speak at this conference and meet this director. We ended up working on the film for sort of a couple of years off and on because she was in Spain and I'm in New York. So it was a little bit tricky to coordinate that sometimes, but it's about my work, it's about Sylvia's work, and it's looking at the ways that witch hunts continue to echo.
What are you hoping to say through your work?
Salem is a story that like everybody knows or thinks they know, and very few people actually engage with it in a real way. Like it's one of America's origin stories. It's one of our sort of foundational myths that we tell over and over and have been telling for the last 330 years. And for all that, there's very little actual engagement outside of academic or historical circles into like what this was and how it does sort of ripple and echo and is a microcosm of a lot of other American political expression. So I'm definitely that's one of the stories that I was interested in telling. The other sort of meta story that I'm interested in telling is trying to answer the question of how do you tell a story about the dead, fundamentally, like about real people who are dead. Like, this is not just fiction. How do you tell a story that sort of is a fictionalized or a recreation about real people who lived and died? And how do we, so that has many sub questions within it, right? From how do you engage with information about women who, Salem is a story fundamentally about women's voices. It's women accusing each other of things, confessing, it's the whole thing is driven by women's voices in a very real way. And they wrote almost nothing down. Everything we know about them is filtered through the pens of the men who were writing things down at the time. So how do you, reconstruct someone from a story that they weren't allowed to write? How do you put them back together? Can you, like, what even is that intention? And what is that effort? And so finally, that ties into the third question, which is like, what do we actually owe to the dead? What do we owe the past? Those are my starting questions.
That's great. And your questions are wonderful in the book. The questions that you just put out right now, they lead to lots of great discussion, further discussion. And that is something we can do as women, is continue to ask the questions. I think about what they were thinking, what questions were they thinking? They may not have been articulating the way we feel free to do it today, but inside, in their minds, maybe to their sisters or their little baby they were holding, they're asking those questions.
Totally.
Yeah. Totally.
We're coming in at the end of the story. And so we get, or what we think of as the end of the story. And so we get to sort of frame it in this way, this holistic way. But it doesn't actually, I think one of the fundamental things that I want to say about Salem is that it's not a story that ends. It's a story that fundamentally is not over, both in terms of the ways that it, that we sort of see it repeat itself on the political and economic level, the social level, but also on the literal level, and the fact that witch hunts still happen every week around the world. So it's, I that actually is a huge part of this for me, that everyone thinks of witch hunts as something that are firmly in the past in this country, because Salem was our last large-scale witch hunt that people know about. And it fundamentally is a story that never ended.
That's very important distinction there, because people look at it, this is 300 some years ago. This was a distant past. We were still, our ancestors were British subjects. This was like happening in a different world.
I think it's ancient history.
Yeah, exactly.
Before we go on to talk about a bit of that history, is there anything else you would like to say about the film or the book?
The book is called The Once and Future Witch Hunt, and it is coming out on May 8th, so in a little less than 2 months. You can actually already pre-order it.
Excellent.
Yeah. We got a sneak peek of that wonderful work, and I'm really excited for it to be out there for people to get it in their hands and in their minds.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes. There's one thing you wrote in there that stood out to me, among others, is Salem is less a history than a Rorschach test. When we tell it, we reveal what we value, what we long for, what we fear. Can you explain that a little more?
Yeah. So I think that one of the most interesting things about looking at Salem is looking at how it's been interpreted and reinterpreted over time, right? So that basically since Salem happened, within 6 years, people are trying to explain it, which is very unusual, actually, for a witch hunt. Like, I don't know of another witch hunt that has been that so much like thought has, that people have spent so much time sort of dredging it up and dissecting it over and over again. But also, I don't know of any witch hunt that within 6 years, major players in the witch hunt, like a judge and members of the jury, were actually getting up in public and apologizing for their part in the witch hunt. And were, you know, it was already being reframed as something wrong. Very unusual. This, like, maybe if you guys know of another witch hunt where this happens, I would be super curious. But I've never come across. And so, like, you know, 6 years after the trials in 1698, they're already, the ministers of the colony are already starting to think about it, like, okay, Salem, these trials were not what we thought they were. This was not, you know, a righteous dredging up of the witches, where this was not a fight for God, where we were the holy soldiers. This was, in fact, a miscarriage of justice where the judges and the jury were misled. And their framing at this point is that the judges and the jury and the accusers were all misled by Satan, right? Like their framing at this point is the devil fooled us into doing this. And the explanation for why the devil would fool them into doing that is that it's punishment for New England's sins overall. And the fact that religiosity has been declining, Puritanism is sort of having some trouble with the newer, there's the sense that the newer generations are less pious, less observant. And so God is pissed off and has let Satan afflict people in the form of the Salem witch trials, which, first of all, whoa, incredible 180 degree switch from 6 years earlier. But so that's the first interpretation. And then over the next century, things start to shift, and the people who Salem comes to be seen as, an example of Christian martyrdom. You know, these people who would rather die than tell a lie under oath because they were so allied with God. And then John Adams in 1774, I think, calls it a stain upon this country, and is already reframing this as this thing we should be ashamed of. And then over the 1800s and 1900s, it's explained as everything, like, people are looking at it as anything from, like, class conflict to religious factionalism to in the 70s, I don't think it was a coincidence that this article comes out in the 70s, that it might have been acid with the rye theory. And I've just always been really interested in looking at, okay, so when a new explanation of why Salem happened comes out, what's the context in which that comes out? The most famous example of this is definitely the Crucible, right? Where he is, Arthur Miller uses Salem as a metaphor for McCarthyism and for the Red Scare, but is sort of simultaneously, like, you know, he wouldn't have written that if it wasn't the time. And that's a much more direct example. But I think that the way that we understand Salem is fundamentally created by our own circumstances and our own sort of political modality and location in a given moment. So that's my sort of, that's the larger answer. But zooming in a little bit, I think also that on a very personal level, Salem is the kind of story that you can look for, you can find almost whatever you're looking for inside it. And there's something of there's something magical about that. There's something of, it's a bit of a shape changer of a story, depending on who you are and what story you're trying to tell. And I think that it's very important for, you know, I wanted to make this clear to readers of my book, as well as just people who are engaging with the Salem story in general, that in a story with so much mystery and so much that will never actually be known, there's always going to be a new interpretation. And, you know, you really want to look at, like, what is the context in which this interpretation is being made?
How could Salem have happened?
There's a model of thinking about witch hunts that I really like that is the wildfire model, which basically says that in order for a witch hunt to take place, you need the ground to be primed for it. You know, in the same way that the ground has to be, there has to be like underbrush building up before a wildfire. There has to be a spark of some kind. There has to be an inciting incident. And then there has to be a period of time in which nobody is like fighting the flames, or even maybe encouraging them. And then it will sort of reach a critical mass and a place at which it can no longer be stopped easily. And I think that that is a really good way to think about Salem, where it is a combination of all of these factors that are laying the groundwork, including the relationship between Salem Town and Salem Village, which was extremely strained and meant that they, you know, Salem Village, where the first accusations begin, is not a place that has political autonomy. It can't like legislate around any of its own problems, which increases the internal issues that the village is having. It's rife. It's just like riven with internal strife. You know, it's ripe with old grudges and deeply, you know, we'll leave it at grudges because that encompasses it. But then simultaneously, you know, why did it? That's like sort of a good way to think about it. It's like, why did the trial start in Salem Village as opposed to anywhere else in Massachusetts? And why did they happen at this particular time? But the wider thing setting the groundwork is Puritanism itself, which is like a religion that really lends itself to witch hunts. Not all the time, but in this particular moment, absolutely, with the focus on fear, on the reality of the devil, the reality of witches, the view of women, the kind of surveillance that Puritanism employed and required, you know, because part of the concept of sin was communal. Like if my neighbor is sinning, that's also bad for me because it's godliness of the whole community. That is part of what matters. It creates a real kind of surveillance age and a place where people are suspicious of each other on a deep level. That's also conducive for a witch hunt. And then, so we have all of that laying the groundwork. And then we have, of course, the spark, which is, two young girls, a 9-year-old girl and an 11-year-old girl, the daughter and the niece of the minister, start having these unexplainable fits. But what I've always thought is really important is that they have these fits for more than a month before anyone is accused of witchcraft. There's this real period of time in which like things could have totally gone another way. Like the kind of fits they were having were not unheard of in Puritan Massachusetts. This is sort of, you know, it's not a regular thing, but it's not a totally irregular thing either, that a young woman might have this kind of reaction to living in the Puritan world, in whatever way it comes about. There's this period of time when it's just sort of happening, and the minister certainly is not trying to fight the flames at this point, and then sort of, you know, decides that he's like actually going to totally fan because he is having all these internal disputes with other members of the village. I'm not saying that that's that it was like an on purpose, I'm going to attack the members of my village, but he was like, yes, everything's going terribly. It makes total sense that everything's going terribly and everyone's mad at me because there are witches around. You know, when you believe in a cult, when you're in a culture that really and truly believes that any misfortune could be because of a witch, you're going to think that that's why. It like makes sense. It's not an outlandish thing. So that's the groundwork, that's the spark. And then one other thing that I always think about is the fact that over the course of the trials, it becomes this idea emerges that the witches are here not just to afflict those teenage girls who were having fits. The witches are not just here to like make your cow sick or cause mischief in some way, or even to kill you. The idea emerges over the summer of 1692 that it's a much greater conspiracy. And in fact, the witches are here to tear down New England. They're here to tear down the Puritan Massachusetts as a whole and get rid of the churches and get rid of the government and put up the devil's kingdom in its place. And this is, it's only articulated that clearly, you know, once or twice, but it, this is sort of the unified like theory of Salem that comes out. And that I've always been really interested in, because the idea that Puritan Massachusetts at this moment was in danger is not incorrect. It's not wrong. They were in this at this moment, they were under a number of threats from without, including they're at war with the Wabanaki in the north, and who are also allied with the French, who are based in Quebec. And so they're fighting a war on the northern border that is like a source of preoccupation and fear for people. They're like literally afraid of being attacked. But also there is this whole business with the charter. So how deep do we want to go in this?
As deep as you want to go.
Yeah, let's do it. So Puritan Massachusetts is founded with the help of the Puritan Charter. And by when I say help of, I mean, that's the only reason they got founded. It's the document from the English crown that says, yes, Puritans, you're allowed to go here and you're allowed to effectively form your own colony, make your own laws, as long as they don't conflict with my laws, and govern yourselves, have a court system, et cetera. And the Puritans love their charter for many years because it lets them effectively set up a Puritan theocracy. And then in the 1680s, the decade before the trials, they lose the charter because they have been very, very naughty and have broken a bunch of English trade laws and have been oppressing lots of Quakers. And the king is like, you have to stop actually taking away your charter. But he puts a governor in place who's an Anglican. The Puritans hate this. They end up actually overthrowing the Anglican governor. But in the meantime, like the reason they overthrow the Anglican governor is that there's also a coup in England, and the king himself is overthrown and replaced by William of Orange in what we now call the Glorious Revolution. So they immediately, the Puritans, when this happens, immediately are like, hey, we've got to get a new charter from the new king. Maybe he'll be more amenable. And they're in negotiations for the charter in the 3 years leading up to the trials, really. They get it in the fall of 1691. And it's on its way back to Massachusetts right in the lead up to the trials, and then literally arrives with a new governor in May of 1692, after a lot of people have been arrested, but before anyone has been hanged yet, before there's been any official trials. And the new charter sucks for the Puritans. I mean, it's, you know, the men who have been negotiating for it try to sell it, but it's really not the old charter. It, first of all, puts the colony much more securely under England's thumb. It makes them much more politically controlled, and it says that they can no longer legally oppress any non-Catholic, any Christian who's not a Catholic. They can still oppress Catholics, but they can't oppress any other Christians legally. And, you know, if we take a step back and think about what that means, it means that the theocracy that they have built is really sort of on the rocks. They're going to have to let other people take part in civic society in a real way. And some people, you know, part of this is just the changing demographics of the colony, but part of it is now this legal shift that's happening. And the Puritans founded this colony with the specific idea that it was going to be a religious project. It was going to be a religious, the famous city on the hill, you know, the idea that it's going to be this beautiful, godly thing that everybody else can look at. But in order for that to happen, they have to have everyone actually be godly and be Puritan and abide by their rules. And so this really sort of shoots that in the foot. And just sort of goes like the zoom out one sentence version of this is that when the Salem witch trials were happening, when they came to believe that the devil was trying to overthrow the churches and the government of Massachusetts and effectively get rid of Puritan theocracy, that theocracy was absolutely in danger. It just wasn't in danger from witches or from the devil. But that fear, that political fear and that sense of the shift is real. That's happening.
Right. The toleration that was enforced upon them, they were required to allow other Protestants to vote. Mm-hmm. So they became, you know, freemen and could affect the elections. So yeah, it was a very precarious situation for the men at the top.
Totally. And I'm not saying that this was then that they were doing the witch trials in sort of an explicit way in response to this, but I like, how could you be going through that and not have this influence your sense of threat and your sense of fear and the feeling that everything that you have worked for is slipping away or is in danger or slipping away? Someone's going to take it.
Right. And the war that was going on was going poorly, was very costly. The incoming governor, William Phipps, had led this horrible expedition to Quebec and lost hundreds of men and, you know, tens of thousands of pounds. So the colonies like literally starts printing money.
Yeah,
all sorts of chaos.
Wasn't really a politician. He was like a treasure hunter. He was he like found a you know, like a sunken ship full of treasure and was like, great, now I'm going to be a nobleman, like, you know, effectively. And is not a politician, he's a soldier. He doesn't really know what to do at all when he shows up and in Massachusetts and they're like, oh yeah, we've got all these witches, can you do something about it? It's like, no, what are you talking about? So there's also this total political, you know, vacuum at the top in the colony when this is happening. There's no, there's like, I would not say that they have a very functional political system at this moment.
Right. And so much of the witch trials fell on the lieutenant governor, William Stoughton, and great guy he was.
What a great guy. When Stoughton becomes Chief Justice of the Witchcraft Court, I mean, he's the one who makes has the final decision in how seriously they're going to take spectral evidence, which was very seriously. And he is the one. I'm so interested in him. He seems to have really, really, really wanted to find and kill witches. Like, really was into this. There's Mary Beth Norton has some really interesting work looking at like the idea that he's compensating for failing to for like losing the war we were talking about. But I'm also just interested, which I think is, you know, totally would also be hard for that not to be some aspect. But I'm also just interested in, like, he was a consummate politician and is now the second in command to a guy who is like not that and is not very good at this and sort of has the opportunity to, like, you know, be the man who's about to save New England from the devil. That might do some weird stuff to your brain.
Absolutely. You mentioned the slipping away of the big picture of what was trying to get established. I could really see through your telling of Martha's story that a sense of that too, not like, you know, of course, the catastrophe that happens to her family with the disease, that's a terrible stripping away, but just her being such a force instead of, you know, she was making her own path and had such a strong personality that, you know, all of I, when you talked about when you wrote about Martha's story, you see all these people having things slip away. And a lot of it is wealth or power, but some of it was within families and it's, you know, they're women. So
totally.
That's powerful.
Martha is a great, she's a great example of two different things. The first one, in terms of like the kind of woman who gets accused of being a witch in Puritan Massachusetts. The first thing is, the best way I can describe it is, you know, like the kind of woman who gets strong-willed, who gets called strong-willed when people like her and just like a straight up bitch when they don't. You know, she's tempestuous. She is very outspoken. And we know from the court records that she had a real penchant of like cursing out her neighbors when she thinks that they're coming to plant on her land. And she's like, you will regret this before 7 years have passed. Like, that's a crazy thing to say. Girl, don't say that. She has a habit of just being very, she's a little bit astringent and very loud. And that is not what Puritan women were expected to be, right? Like this is not the ideal Puritan matron. She's certainly not being that. She also was 7 months pregnant when she was married. So she's sort of known as a deviant in other realms as well, which also, you know, huge black mark in the Puritan book. And so she's got this sort of, there's like an inversion of power in her household from the outside, where it's like she's this sort of very strong, very outspoken woman. And simultaneously, she, as we've said, so when both her parents and her brothers and a number of her other relatives die in a smallpox outbreak a couple years before the trials. And she is living with she's already like in Andover living with her parents on their farm. And so she and her family get blamed for having brought the smallpox and killed her parents and her brothers and her siblings. But the fact of her brothers dying along with her father means that there is no longer a male heir in that family to inherit the farm. And this turns out to be a major risk factor for getting accused of witchcraft. Carol Carlson is a historian who has an excellent book about this called The Devil in the Shape of a Woman. And she did a survey of all of the witch hunts that happened in Puritan New England, and found that a really astounding number of them, of women who were accused and then were convicted and executed, were women who belonged to families where there was no male heir to inherit property. So these were women who either stood to or did inherit property that would usually go to a man. And she makes the excellent point that these women sort of by their very existence interrupt the Puritan property system and are sort of an implicit challenge to primogeniture and to the idea that to the male inheritance system. And Martha fits into this to a T. Plus, she has the added issue of being blamed for actually killing them. But it's both the fact of even, you know, standing to potentially inherit that land that turns out to be a risk factor.
And that still seems to be a risk factor in the modern accusations as well.
Totally. This seems to be, you know, land seems to be embedded in so many witch hunts across time. And certainly today, we hear stories all the time of women who are accused when, you know, by some women and men who are accused when someone in their family desires their land. This usually happens to women if they're widows, if their husband has died or their father has died or something, and they've inherited this land that somebody else wants. But this will also absolutely happen to men. It's a huge problem in certain parts of Kenya, for example, where older men will be accused by somebody in their family, basically in order to remove them from the land, is the way that it's credited, which is a really classic witch hunt formula. Because a witch hunt, you know, it depends on someone being assigned, being demonic, being made to seem totally demonic. And it's just like very hard to escape that accusation, that stain, once it's been leveled at you. And so it really can sort of clear the way for a land grab, if that's what someone's interested in. And I think that we're definitely seeing evidence that there are certainly witch hunts that are just attempts to take land sort of blatantly. I do think there's another layer where sometimes there are land disputes where it's not an explicit attempt to grab the land, but the land dispute is still what causes the witch hunt, mm-hmm. in the sense of what I was talking about a little bit before with the minister who's, you know, freaking out in Salem about the fact that there are witches and everyone's mad at him. If you are in a society where you absolutely believe in witches and you are in a land, you've been in a long time land dispute, say with your neighbor or your uncle or your aunt or something, and some misfortune befalls you, you know, your child gets sick or dies, you have economic ruin, whatever it might be. If you attribute that to witchcraft, you're going to look for, when you start to look for the witch, you're going to look for someone who you know is mad at you. You're going to look for someone who you know hates you or has it out for you in some way. And somebody who you've had a long-standing land dispute with is like the perfect scapegoat for that, the perfect target. So that's the other way in which the land dispute can cause a witch hunt without explicitly being a land grab.
That's an important distinction. Thank you for clarifying that. And neighborly disputes in general are something that people often look back at once they start looking for somebody to blame, especially the ill-chosen words of, you know, you'll regret that within 7 years, those kinds of things stand out in people's memories all of a sudden when they're looking for a witch.
Totally. And I think that's a great example, again, of the Rorschach test of Salem. You know, the fact that, like, both when we look at Salem as a whole or look at witch hunts as a whole, but also within Salem, the whole story is a story of people looking at things that other people have said to them and trying to see what they want to see. Like, that's what this is all about. And I think that's absolutely a huge risk factor. I know that this was also the case in some of the, Keith Thomas has done some good work on this in terms of the witch hunts in Europe and in England, that this was a pattern between, you know, between neighbors, between like, if someone is vagrant and asking for charity and the person who they ask. So it's the sort of these like ongoing acrimonious interactions. And I think that there's something really interesting there in terms of the way that, like, when we talk about how a town, the fabric of a town, like, works or doesn't, how disputes resolve themselves or don't, the little things that sort of bother you and fester, and the small issues that you have with someone over time repeating itself, those are great. It's a great witch hunt fodder. Because as soon as something goes wrong, as soon as you have that spark, you're going to go back and look at like every time somebody was mad at you, every time someone decided to curse you out and say, I will like stick to you as close as the bark has ever stuck to a tree and will regret it. You're like, whoa. That's a Martha quote. She says that to her neighbor he's mad at. And of course, it's like gets read into the trial record as an accusation later. So,
I love that your project doesn't just, you know, mention what's happening in our world right now with witch hunts, but your work and your research with it just, you know, it's part of your story of Martha, because, you know, these stories are all, you know, there's a thread there. What can you tell us about how you got involved in the modern advocacy?
Yeah, I mean, so it was really important to me that would be part of the book itself. Going back into how everyone thinks that this is a story that's over, that's located firmly in the past. And I was like, I actually think you can't understand Salem if you think of it as something that only exists in the past and something that couldn't happen today. It's very important to locate it in its specific time period, political, economic, religious situation. But it is fundamentally a story that's not over. And so I thought it was very important to bring in the fact that witch hunts are happening. And I, in my original research, I had sort of run across articles every so often of like, here's someone who was killed, here's someone who was killed. But I'd been under the impression, to be honest, that it was like rare, and that these were sort of one-off things. And it is not rare. We're going to go right back to Sylvia. I really started to get into this when the day that I met Sylvia, I went to hear her speak about something. And at the end of her talk, she cited this like very, again, a very sort of casual, cited the statistic very casually, where she said that in the past 30 years, 30,000 people had been the victims of witch hunts. And I was like, hold up, wait, 30,000 people in 30 years is 1,000 people a year. That's like 2 to 3 people per day. That is a rate that far outstrips Europe, far outstrips. Like, we're not going to, like, Salem is panting back in the dust, if it's an ongoing thing. And if it's like, population wise, it's still it's definitely a small number of people in the world. But it was just so much more frequent than I understood. And so I started to get in touch with people who are organizing against witch hunts, studying witch hunts, often where they live or nearby. I learned a ton from them. Once you start to look at it, people are doing some really interesting and powerful work on this. Got to know Sashi Prabha Bindani, who is the former state commissioner of Odisha, India, who was instrumental in passing their anti-witch hunting law, and Leo Igwe, who runs Advocacy for Alleged Witches, who I know you guys have spoken to. Then got involved with the International Network Against Accusations of Witchcraft and Associated Harmful Practices. I know it's a really long name. You can just find it at theinternationalnetwork.org. But it's a group of us who are organizers, scholars, or reporters who are sort of trying to build connections between the people working on this in different places. To facilitate those connections, but also to see how we can share information and best practices in terms of like what works to stop witch hunts. Because we've spent so much time, so many years thinking about why these witch hunts happen. And we have to think about that in order to understand how to stop them. But let's also come up with some like practical ways of like, how can we support people and communities to do less witch hunting?
Where should listeners or readers start for getting involved?
When they become aware of modern witch hunts, it's a great question. You can definitely. We have a lot of information on our website at theinternationalnetwork.org. So they have a lot of resources place by place, and you can look up depending on where you are located. You can look into different work that's been done in that place. You can look and find, is there an organization near me that works on this? If there's not, totally, that's okay. And I think the most important thing in that case is to just start to read, there's news articles all the time about this, but I mean more also that, there's some more comprehensive articles. If you Google some, why are witch hunts still happening today? You'll find a variety of things, but we can point you in the right direction. But I think the main thing is really just to tell the story and, you know, sort of talk about the fact that this is not a thing of the past. This is not an isolated incident, but is rather part of, and this is not like a thing that has to do with superstition. Like, it's not about people just like being extra superstitious in some places. Like, no, like just like Salem, witch hunts happening today are happening because of complex political, economic, and religious forces that are interacting to produce this kind of to produce a witch hunt. But it's not, it like actually has very, it's belief is not the deciding factor of whether or not a witch hunt happens. Plenty of people believe in witches and are not having witch hunts. There's always a political, economic, religious factor to this. And so I would really keep that in mind and just start to, start to read.
Right. And to go back to the wildfire analogy, a lot of that ground has been primed due to the complicated situations you're talking about. There's so many wars, terrorism. We've had a pandemic. There's other epidemic diseases in locations. The weather's not so good. So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that all of those work very well as sparks. As well, you know, like I've definitely heard from a lot of people that the pandemic or like it, unexplained illnesses or illnesses that, you know, some sudden deaths, lack of access to comprehensive healthcare, these are some of the most common sparks for witch hunts. It's some of the most common reasons that a witch hunt will happen in a specific place at a specific time. But the underlying ground there, I think, is also something I've heard a lot from people who are organizing against witch hunts, is that so much of it is economic and is like, you know, when there's a great analysis of some witch hunts in Kenya in the 1990s and sort of tracing the fact that as the government of Kenya cut social services and cut because of the loans that they were receiving from the World Bank at the time, the IMF, what came along with those, a lot of those loans in the 1980s and 1990s was the instruction that they had to cut the belt tightening condition. So they had to cut a lot of social services, cut education, cut healthcare, cut food subsidies. As those policies go into effect in Kenya, the witch hunts increase, which is like not that surprising because it's like when people feel like things are sort of going horribly, they're much more likely to engage in this. But it also it's quite something to sort of see it spelled out so clearly. And so I think that it is also something to pay attention to in terms of like, what are the international overarching, you know, economics that are helping to prime this ground? What are the national and international relations that are helping to prime this ground? And I think that we really have to look at it. Like, how does privatization of land on a very large scale play into this and then play into the land scarcity that then causes more people to have land disputes and causes more witch hunts? Would people be having that same experience if so much of this land hadn't been, you know, grabbed by Monsanto or whatever it is? So it's like there's some macro forces that interact with very micro place-specific interactions. And I think that that's one of the important things to, like, we have to hold both of those at once, which is difficult because it's, there's no, like, one-size-fits-all explanation for witch hunts, but there certainly are patterns. And so my book, The Once and Future Witch Hunt, will be out on May 8th from Llewellyn. And you can find updates about it on my website, which is alicemarkhamcantor.com. And I'll be posting about it there. And I don't think I have anything else in particular. I think we covered a lot. Thank you both so much. It was great to get to talk and to meet semi in person. Yeah, thank you so much for this conversation.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for this really great conversation.
Mary Louise Bingham is back with A Minute with Mary. As previously reported, end witch hunts have started to track legal cases in the United States where the vulnerable are victims of harmful practices because they are believed to be possessed by an evil spirit. The second of now four cases of which are most likely going to trial this year is that of 8-year-old Lila Castle of Wayne, Michigan, whose mother, Chelsea DePerrin, believed Lila was possessed by an evil spirit. This past March 14th, police found Lila was beaten so badly over a period of time that she had to wear diapers because she could not walk to the bathroom. Lila did not survive. Her mother's preliminary hearing, originally scheduled for April 1st, did not happen. The reason is that Chelsea is being evaluated to see if she is competent to stand trial. We will know more after May 20th and will certainly keep our listeners informed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
Now here's Sarah with this week's edition of End Witch Hunts News.
End Witch Hunts is the nonprofit organization affiliated with our podcast, and this is a word from our nonprofit. Our vision is a world without witch hunts where all victims are exonerated, modern victims and their families receive justice, and tribute is paid to past victims. Please visit our show notes to access an important interview that was just released with legal professor Miranda Forsyth from the School of Regulation and Global Governance at ANU and founding advocate for the International Network Against Accusations of Witchcraft and Associated Harmful Practices, hosted by Sasha Barber Gott. On Australia's daily news podcast, The Briefing, this conversation explains how actual witch hunts and spiritual and ritual abuse continue to impact communities worldwide. Dr. Forsyth shares how vulnerable people worldwide are still being persecuted and often murdered on suspicion of being involved in witchcraft, often driven by spiritual and ritual abuse, poverty, or civil conflict. She talks about who is at risk, why they're being targeted, and what's being done to address the issue. Miranda eloquently explains that it might seem like we've moved on from historic witch trials, but that tragically, people are still being persecuted for witchcraft in many communities in Africa, India, and Papua New Guinea, and other countries. In 2020, the United Nations reported that at least 20,000 alleged witches were killed across 60 countries between 2009 and 2019. Miranda addresses this complex crisis and explains that there are lots of reasons for it. Quote, when things are uncertain, when bad events happen, when there's unexplained illness and deaths, then in many countries, people turn to ask who has caused this. And where there is a narrative that sorcerers and witches are real, then people turn to asking which of their neighbors or which of their family members might have caused this particular misfortune. In the country that Forsyth has spent the most time advocating, Papua New Guinea, she reports that they see regular cases where people are accused. This can lead to stigmatizations and banishment from a community, and it also leads to actual cases of physical violence and torture and death. Witch Hunt Podcast had the opportunity to interview Miranda at length about Papua New Guinea witchcraft accusations, and you can find the link to that previous podcast episode in this week's show notes. I hope you take the time to listen to expert Miranda Forsyth in the episodes I have mentioned above. Keep learning about the modern witch hunt crisis, and keep the conversation going in your sphere of influence. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to Witch Hunt.
Join us every week.
Have a great today and a beautiful tomorrow.